please, Honorable Kenneth Jacobs. We were to have started the meeting at 13:30, and I note that, yes, Honorable Dloma has been able to reconnect. Honorable Dloma, I was just going to welcome everyone because you seem to have lost your position. But you're very welcome. Thank you very much, Chair. Continue.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Mr. Jacobs, for holding on the fort while one was trying to log in. I was going through the security check in April and therefore needed to clear that part. Thanks for welcoming all the members. For members, just to inform you, last night, Honorable Gela was admitted into a hospital. I've just spoken to her daughter an hour ago, who promised that she will make me speak to her. They will be going to see her in the afternoon. So that apology also needs to be noted. I will take it that you remember that this meeting is taking place as if it is in the precinct of Parliament, and therefore everything that you say is as if it's said in Parliament, and members therefore could just be mindful of that part. And we would like to be supported going forward through proper processes of taking this meeting forward. May I, so that I can move away from this noise, ask Dr. Jacobs to call the presenters who have joined in. I hope NHLS is there, and then I will link up when I may be able to get out of the noise.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dloma. We have this afternoon the HLS presenting to us, Honorable Members, and we would like to see and hear from our secretary whether they have joined the meeting. I have seen the name of Professor Derek Book. Ms. Majalamba, can you just inform us about the presence of NHLS's representatives on the platform? Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Jacobs, they are in the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Professor Buch, and your other representatives, please introduce them to us so that we can get your presentation. And you have 45 minutes for your presentation. Thank you. You may go ahead.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jacobs, and Honorable Dormo. The NHLS delegation today is myself, the Vice Chairperson of the Board of the NHLS, Professor Jeffrey Mkhwele, and one of the members of our Governance Committee, Professor Mary Ross, and then our CEO, Dr. Cammy Chetty, is here. She will be doing the presentation on behalf of the NHLS, but just to say that the original submission to Parliament was on the NHI in relation, the NHLS in relation to the NHI was considered in some depth by the board and approved by the board. Therefore, Dr. Chetty's presentation is really a presentation at the level of the board's perspective, well supported by the executive team in the NHLS, led by Dr. Chetty, who, of course, is in her own right a board member. So without any further delay, I'll hand over to Dr. Chetty, and she'll start her screen share. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I'm just going to load the presentation onto the screen. In the boardroom, we've got members of the executive management team with the acting CFO and the finance team, including the company secretary, the senior manager for evaluation and monitoring, and the national priority program. So thank you, Chair. I'm going to just load the presentation. As the chair has indicated, I'm going to turn off my bandwidth, my video for bandwidth. As the chair has indicated, this is the submission made by the NHLS to the portfolio committee. And I'm not going to go through the details because of the constraints on time. Everybody is aware that the NHLS is a Schedule 3A public entity that is specifically set up to provide services to the public health sector and to a small extent to the private health sector. Importantly, that the mandate included not only diagnostic services, at research and training as well. The NHLS has got a number of institutes. So we've got the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, the National Institute of Occupational Health, the South African Vaccine Producers, and the Diagnostic Media Products. And the reason as to why we are outlining this chair is that in the NHI, we also need to take cognizance of the fact that there a number of the services that are unique to the NHLS, such as being the only anti-venom producer for snake bites and scorpions, which is an absolutely essential service, that this also needs to be taken into account in the NHI, including the workplace-based services through the NIOH. And we all are very much aware of the importance of the NICD and the role it has been playing with regard to the surveillance of communicable diseases. So this slide just highlights that. Just to give you an idea of the scope of the services of the NHLS, and I think we quite often overlook the fact that about 95% of all clinical diagnoses are made through pathology services. So without the NHLS, there's a huge proportion of patients would not be easily diagnosed. And in some instances, it's thought that it goes up to 100% of all clinical diagnosis gets made through laboratory and pathology services. This slide just shows the extent of the number of people that the NHLS serves. So about 56 million patients in the public health sector. We service, importantly, every area of the country, and we service all of the public clinics. So the scope of work is huge, and we do this through a network of laboratories. So this map shows we've got 233 laboratories in the 9 provinces, and in the past year we've conducted 97 million tests for hospitals and clinics, and this gives you the breakdown of the tests in the different provinces. I'm not going to go through the details of that. So importantly, with regards to the NHI, the NHLS board and the NHLS staff are committed to the principle of providing universal access and quality health services for all South Africans. I think we're all very much aware of universal health coverage and what has been outlined in the NHI bill. And so I'm not going to go through the details there, but I think that the NHLS is absolutely committed to the fact that health services should be given to the communities without the communities suffering any financial hardships. And we have to ensure that it's quality health services that are given and that we concentrate on the full spectrum of care, not just in curative care, but on health promotion, and prevention. So with the introduction of NHI, we know that the NHI is going to ensure that everyone has access to appropriate, efficient, and quality health services. For the NHLS, we believe it's quite important that we look at the whole issue of affordability and quality, regardless of the socioeconomic status of the population. and we're very confident that NHI is going to open up access to health services. In our presentation to the Portfolio Committee in our 5-year strategic plan, we outlined our strategic objectives as improving quality and improving clinical effectiveness, but importantly that we also get the whole issue of cost effectiveness, so that we do more or at equal or higher quality at a much lower cost. And this requires the appropriate use of laboratory tests and ensuring that there is value for money. So this is an important aspect, Chair, and this is something that has been endorsed by the International Federation of Pathology Services. Under NHI, we believe that the NHLS has a mandate, I've already spoken about the NHLS mandate of diagnostic services. I want to emphasize the importance not only of teaching. We're the only ones who train pathologists, but we also train medical technologists, medical technicians, laboratory assistants, and phlebotomists. But importantly, the research component of the NHLS is also extremely important, because this has been evidenced by the outbreaks of listeriosis, for example, as well as with COVID-19. Because if it's not where for the research and the data from the NHLS and the NICD, I think the population of South Africa would have been very poorly informed of the pandemic and what is happening in South Africa, and we hold our own internationally in being able to with the studies and research that we do, not just for outbreaks but for all the other diseases that affect South Africa. We're also proud of the fact that we provide high quality, very efficient and cost-effective services. And I think I need to point out that the NHLS Act provides us with a mandate or states quite clearly that the public health sector must purchase laboratory services from the NHLS. So we're the designated service provider for the public sector. Under the NHI, we believe that we're the only pathology services that could adequately provide the coverage and equitable access across the country through our 233 labs. There's no other pathology service that covers the remote rural areas as we do, and we've got a much wider footprint than any other service in this country. We also know that no other service is able to deliver as we can. And we've got the capacity to easily expand and cover the population that we're not covering, which is the 20% of the population, and no other service will be able to do that. Some of the principles of UHC, and I'm not going to go through the details yet, Chair, because you know it very well, but the important aspect is that NHI, as one of the principles, is to look to migrate from a two-tier to a single-tier system. And we know that this is especially important because when we look at our history and the fact that we've come from a very fragmented service, and the system has been proposed for a long time, but yet we still continue with the two-tier system, not just in the laboratory sector, but also in the health sector as a whole. And we know that the two-tier system is unsustainable and very costly. We provided you with some details of the burden of disease. And the main point, I'm not going to go through the whole slide here, the main point that I need to make is the fact that the major burden of diseases with regard to the diseases of poverty, such as HIV and TB, the NHLS has done the bulk of those services, and there's quite significant volumes that we do. We've got the largest HIV program, testing program, and nationally and also internationally. It's one of the largest. With the TB burden, we know that there's a lot of pressure to reach our 90-90-90 targets, and this is an extremely important mandate of the NHLS. We also know that the role that the NHLS has played, as I've told you already, on the pandemic, and the issue around non-communicable diseases is extremely important, and is also quite a large mandate of the NHLS. We know that non-communicable diseases is going to be increasing, and we provide a cancer service through the National Cancer Registry, and we know that cancer itself is going to be increasing and is estimated to increase by at least 30% by 2030. The diseases of lifestyle, such as cardiovascular diseases, hypertension, and dyslipidemia, are also on the increase. We know that a number of individuals, over half the population, have one or more of those diseases. So this is just to illustrate the burden of disease in South Africa and the fact that the NHLS is ideally placed in order to be able to deal with this huge burden of disease. So, Chair, in using the Universal Health Coverage Cube, we put in the stats, and this is from 2019. The stats, some of the stats were taken from the Competition Commission Market Inquiry, where these figures were given, and we have extrapolated it. So the public sector takes care of 80% of the population, the expenditure that the public sector has is about $7 billion, which was in 2019. That has now subsequently increased. And I have got updates and stats with regard to that. The private sector takes care of 20% of the population, and the expenditure at that particular time, so we're looking at the expenditure during that particular financial year, which was $8.1 billion. So, Chair, this, when we talk about the two-tier system and the inequities, we've got a private sector population taking care of 20% of the population, which is spending more on laboratory services than what is being spent in the public sector of $7 billion for 80% of the population. We also do some tests for the private sector, so our range of tests is a lot wider, so we provide more services, and as a result, we get the referrals from the private sector for some of these low-volume esoteric tests. We also, in some instances, outsource some of our services to the private sector, but overall, the majority of the services is provided by us. So extrapolating that further, Chair, and again, I've said that I've taken this straight from the submission we made, which was in 2019, but we've got updated figures with regards to that. In 2019, we did 91 million tests in the public sector. That has now increased to about 97 million. In the private sector, the stats that are given to the Competition Commission, when we extrapolate it, comes to about 53 million tests done in the private sector. That may be higher, but these are the figures that we are using, and it's just a simple test that we've done. We just then looked at the expenditure at that particular time, then what is the average expenditure per test, and again, if the tests are higher in the private sector, then the average expenditure will go down. We've done an extrapolation where if we look that if the private sector does the same amount of tests as the public sector, we still found that the average expenditure per test was higher than the NHLS. But if you look at the figures of the total population that is served, clearly, this is the correct population at that time, then the per capita expenditure, the cost per person. If you look at dividing that population by the expenditure, it's 153 rand per capita for the public sector patients, which is what the NHLS spends, and 702 rand for the private sector patients. And I know that there'll be sort of a lot of questions around this, Chair. Let me also say that the expenditure of the private sector, as outlined in the Council for Medical Schemes report for 2020, was 10.5 billion. So, and when you then look at the population that has been served, with the info from the Council for Medical Schemes, is about 16% and not 20%. So the per capita expenditure then becomes a lot higher and goes to just over 1,000 rand. So Chair, I've spent some time on that because I think it is important when we look at these comparisons, because the important point that we want to make is that the higher costs in the private sector shows that with NHI, if we start looking at moving the cost down and getting it closer to, even if we look at the average cost between the two sectors, there's still going to be huge cost savings under the NHI. So clearly, we've made recommendations in around each one of the aspects of the bill. The single purchaser and single payer principle, we're fully supportive of that. We believe that it gives us absolute strategic advantages with having only one buyer for the purchasing of services. Again, the NHLS has got experience with regards to this. It's because we are also a single purchaser of the laboratory services, we are able to get much greater economies of scale when we procure. We also believe that the NHI fund will be able to look at the prices that can be set and the standards that also need to be set for healthcare services. So we really believe that it's a good funding mechanism to achieve the UHC objectives. With regards to the issue around the NHLS as a designated service provider, we are recommending that the fund contracts with the NHLS as a designated service provider for all pathology services. And this is the case for the transition period. It's in the bill. It states that the pathology services will be provided by the NHLS. But we are recommending that the bill gets amended to allow this to be the case beyond the transition period. And there are distinct advantages of having the NHLS as a designated service provider, because we will be able to streamline both service provision as well as the pathology payments. And being a designated provider does not mean that the private sector will not be providing services, but the NHLS will then subcontract according to on a per capita basis and according to the size of the population that's been serviced. So we're suggesting that if we are the designated service provider, we also know that the whole burden of monitoring, provision and payments of pathology services can be taken away from the fund, as the NHLS can perform this and then report on a regular basis to the fund. And we believe that we have got the required infrastructure, skills and competency to do it, because we are already doing that. Importantly, as a designated service provider, one of the most important things in the NHI is going to be the whole issue of the information that's required. We have already got a national lab information system. And this is with all our laboratories. We've got an extremely well-established corporate data warehouse, which is a repository of all of the laboratory data, and it's a huge resource both for the NHI as well as for the NHS. So it will be important that if the NHLS is the designated service provider, we will then be able to collect information for every single person that uses the NHI and uses the diagnostic services, because otherwise, if it's done at a local level, that information is going to be lost. So we want to stress this, because being the designated service provider is going to do the NHI fund much more, so it has much more advantages. Then we are able to use that to look at test utilization. We can look at the burden of diseases, and we'll also be able to interface with the patient record system so that the lab data becomes part of the communication with the patient. And we also are looking at an electronic order entry system to try to facilitate paperless test ordering as well. The composition of the board, we support the concept of technical representation. From our experience, we know that organizational representatives have got the advantage of being able to provide feedback on end-user experience. We believe that that's important. We think that there should be consideration given to the cost of setting up and running the board. And there was a suggestion that the fund could be run as a government component or agency if a board is not set up. We'd recommend that with regard to the financing mechanism, there needs to be much more detail on the financing mechanism. And we believe that if we need the designated service provider after the transition period, that we can determine the financing mechanism with the fund and then subcontract with the private laboratories. We also believe that there needs to be a cap put on utilization in order to prevent over-servicing. As we've said, we've got vast experience in contracting out to the private sector and reimbursing the private sector for services rendered. The benefits package, the benefit design, we believe that the board should state whether the benefit package will be implicit, that's what is in the package, or explicit, that will be excluded, but it shouldn't stay silent on how the benefit design should be. The bill should also state how benefits will be paid for if it's not in the benefit package. From experience, again, whatever gets excluded, there's major challenges with regards to that. We also believe that the fund should allow for duplicative health insurance. So everybody must be compelled to contribute to mandatory prepayment. However, those who want to buy a similar package through voluntary insurance should be allowed to do so, because that will reduce the burden on the NHI fund. What we need to ensure, however, is that that doesn't lead to a two-tier system, and we believe that the risk can be mitigated by the fund administering or prescribing administered prices for the voluntary packages. So in conclusion, Chair, I've stated already that the NHLS and the board is fully supportive of the initiative to deliver universal health coverage through the NHI. I've already shown how pivotal the pathology services are in the delivery of health services, and we believe that we can play a role in improving access. We also know that with universal health coverage, there'll be an increased demand for diagnostic testing, both from a clinical point of view as well as for screening. And we have got the data, and it will be important to get private sector data to look at how best to be able to look at utilization and cost. Okay, and I've covered the fact that we are placed to improve both the mandates of access and coverage. We've got unique pathology experience. I think it needs to be stressed that every pathologist who works in the private sector was trained by the NHLS or the predecessors at some stage or the other. We need to stress that our platform for coverage, lower cost, existing data systems and pathology expertise, that put us in a unique position to fulfill our public health mandates. And as I've said, that nobody else can do what we do, so we're really well positioned. So I thank you, Chair.
So thank you very much, Dr. Petty. So Honourable Jacobs, I think the core message from us at the NHLS is that we understand the imperatives and value and potential of the NHLS, that we as the NHLS are well positioned to transition into the National Health Insurance System and to offer an efficient national platform with high service standards and low costs, and that as a designated service provider, we are ready to meet the need to scale up our services in line with the NHI objectives of universal access to care for all our citizens, all our people, that we are able, we already have a wide national platform and are able to expand that as required. You've seen from our graphs that we've previously shown you that we have laboratories all around the country, and that we have data systems that will be able to provide the information that will be required for effective management in the National Health Insurance. So thank you very much for affording us the opportunity to present to your committee today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Book and Dr. Chetty, for this presentation. Honourable members, I do not see your hands on the platform. I know that Honourable Romo is also back. Let me continue just as he indicates to me. So I have seen on our group, there is one hand from Honourable Sukhacha. I think the hand from Honourable Masadan is that hand. And then the hand after that, Honourable Dlomo is Tel, and then Honourable Munyai. So I see Honourable Dlomo is back on the system. Please continue.
Yes, thank you very much. I would hope that you have taken the hand. I was raising my hand to join in also to speak. But in the list that you provided, the colleagues, honourable members, that I hope you gave the honourable Sukhacha number one.
Yes, honourable Sukhacha number one, and I asked honourable Masadan whether they should move that because I think that is a bigger land.
No, that's an all down, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Good, and thank you very much. Then it's followed by myself, and then Honourable Munyai, and then Honourable Dlomo yourselves. That's the order.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thank you very much, Honourable. Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Let me take this opportunity to thank Dr. Chetty for the presentation. Just one question, Honourable Chair, from my side. I just want Dr. Chetty to indicate what was their experience they gained during the COVID-19 period. Because I want to check, Chair, the point that she has been making, that they are a designated service provider and the subcontracting of the private labs concept. I want to check that, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. It will be my opportunity. We've noted in the presentation from Dr. Chetty that the services they provide are to 46.5 million people. Compared to the number of the population that they had stipulated as 38 million people. And I also note that the price per test which they perform on average is about a fifth of the price that people pay in the private sector. So my question is, if you still have the skills, the competency, the infrastructure, I would just like to hear about your capacity to be able to do the testing for all of the people of South Africa, because clearly there's only a difference of 12 million people as per your presentation. And I think the scalability would definitely not be a challenge for yourself. You could maybe answer on that. And then how do you reconcile your support for a duplicative cover to reduce the fragmentation and multiple risk pools? In other words, how do you think will we achieve solidarity in a duplicative environment? And what are your views on actually taking us to that position, apart from you saying that you would wish to be a designated service provider for the NHI? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Sokacha, I'm sorry, Munai.
Yeah, I would appreciate to ask them a very concrete question on financing. Whether should the bill spell out funding for every provider on focus on the principle? That is the first question. Should the details of the allocation not be left to the budget process and the allocation? The other critical issues that I think need to be taken forward: do they support concretely the NHI as it is? And what about, can the NHL, for instance, clarify the experience they gained during the COVID-19 period to highlight the point of a designated service provider and subcontracting of the private labs concept? This is very critical issue. But another issue I want to understand is that whether they are comfortable with the current two-tier system of the healthcare system in the country, which left majority and the poor people of South Africa not having the access to quality of healthcare. Because with these two tiers, most of the money goes to private aid medical schemes and so on, rather than really going to save our people. Can they clarify their position concretely? I would want to understand as to, as an organization, they support the NHI, and including those issues that I've raised.
Okay. Are you finished, Honorable Munyai?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. This is my mistake. I'll improve going forward.
Okay. Honorable members, I would probably just want to check that per capita expenditure on private and public. If during COVID there were any discussions, for us going forward, you will have to be one service provider for health, for laboratory services. If there has not been any discussion, or if you think there could be a discussion around a unitary price, exit price, for especially the indigent of the country in terms of the service. I know where you are in terms of your per capita expenditure, whether you could probably think that it would be possible to have a discussion. And have you started, just leaning on what Honorable Sokacha said, whether there has been any collaborative discussions as you were navigating COVID? Was COVID made us to come together, both private and public, but in your space as a laboratory services, whether there was any of such programs? Dr. Kemi Chetty and Professor Boch, you can then help us with responses.
So thank you very much. I'll respond to the sort of governance level questions. So in terms of the support for the NHI, And the principles embedded it in, and the broad direction of it, the board of the NHLS was very clear in expressing its support. The board, however, did not get into the details of the detailed models for the NHI, because that was outside of, if you like, our mandate as a Section 3A public entity. So we did not debate sort of some different alternatives around, for example, the operational mechanics of the NHI. But we certainly do support broader measures such as achieving universal access, equitable care for all South Africans, as well as issues of contracting against performance standards and many of the other features that the NHI will offer to achieve both greater equity for all South Africans, improved efficiency in the health system, and ultimately better value for the public, for the total expenditure on healthcare in the country, and consequently the benefits not just to healthcare but to the health of all our people. So we foresee an improvement in health outcomes. So I think that is the model. In terms of how we operate within that model, we look forward to the idea of performance-based contracting and to meeting the expectations and demands, because we are confident of the quality, efficiency, and value for money of the services that we provide, and that we have the platform available to ramp up to meet the increased needs for healthcare that will come with increased access to health services, including specialized health services and the consequent laboratory tests that will be required to support that. I think that I'll then hand over to the CEO to respond, and I don't know if any of the other board members would like to comment at the governance level before I hand over to the CEO.
Not from my side at this stage.
Thanks, Prof. Mpahlele. Okay, so Dr. Chetty.
Thanks very much, Prof. Book. So with regard to Member Sukachwa's question, with our experience gained in COVID-19, I think as has been mentioned by the chair of the portfolio committee, in that COVID-19 and all sectors brought together the public and the private sectors, and that's been exactly our experience with regards to the pandemic. So we worked in a very cooperative manner, not just with the private sector, but also with the academic sector. We all pulled together knowing that by working together, we're going to be able to deliver on the mandate to do the testing for COVID-19. The private sector, when they were overloaded with tests, would refer to us. When we had an overload of tests, we would refer to the private sector. And that's the kind of sort of cooperative model that we see working in the NHI, because the private sector would also have a role to play in diagnostic testing. We also pulled on all the academics as well as the NGO sector, who needs to subcontract with in order to be able to perform the test. The payments used to be done by the NHLS, it is to be done quite efficiently. We've got a system where our lab information system is able to know exactly what tests we've contracted to which laboratory, and then have a billing system linked to that. So the experience that we've gained in COVID-19, but also the experience that we've had now since inception of the NHLS puts us, as I said, in this unique position to be able to do that quite easily. And we would have details. We've got a system of also being able to monitor the quality of the tests as well. Member Jacobs, you've raised the issue of our capacity to testing for all South Africans. And as you've indicated, it's 20% of the population, we can easily cover that. And as I've indicated, not only with the bulk of the routine tests, but we're the only one to do some of the rare tests. So we believe that that will be easily done. But the model that we're looking at, as I said, is that it doesn't necessarily that we do all of the tests. We work out a system where 20% of the tests can then be subcontracted to the private sector with administered at set prices, so that we don't have overcharging and over-servicing. With regards to the issue of a duplicate cover and how do we achieve solidarity with that, I did indicate that there's a risk that two-tier system will continue, but what we're stressing is that the solidarity will be reached by ensuring that there's mandatory prepayment or mandatory payment to the NHI fund, so everybody is compelled to pay. And we believe that the very small proportion thereafter that would be able to afford having duplicate cover. And what's in the NHI bill now is top-up cover, but we think that's the very small proportion that's going to afford that. And the solidarity would be achieved by the prepayment into the for all citizens. And that was easily, again, when I'm saying that we should be the designated service provider, is that we should be the provider that the NHI fund contracts with, and if there is subcontracting, then it's done through the NHLS. So the model does fit in, and as I said, we've got experience of doing that right now. Then with regard to member Munyai's a question. Munyai, we agree with you. We don't think that the bill should have every detail of every funder or supplier. It just needs to have the principle there. And as in other countries, you then have a schedule with your regulation that provides more of the details. We do support the notion that the legislation should be enabling with the details in the regulations, because we also know that if there's any amendments that need to be made, it's much more difficult to get an amendment made to the bill than to change a regulation. So we do support the principle of enabling legislation. I think that, the chair has spoken about the fact that the NHLS wholeheartedly supports the NHI, and we believe that it needs to be implemented as soon as possible. I've spoken about our experience during COVID-19. Just to say that with the COVID-19 testing, from the stats, you would see that the private sector has done more tests than the public sector. And we often get asked, why is it that the public sector is not doing the tests? But I think I need to point out that it's not the NHLS that drives the testing. So it isn't, we don't drive demand. It's the clinicians in the hospital who decide as to whether tests get done, and they would do the test and then send it across to us, and we would perform the test. So the numbers are not driven by us. Unlike in the private sector, where demand is driven by the access that they set up through drive-through centers, etc., we service the public hospitals and clinics, and whatever samples are given are drawn by them, this is what we do. Okay, and our initial experience that initially, yes, we had problems with backlogs due mainly to the fact that the suppliers were problematic, you know, with the lockdowns and suppliers not having enough stock, etc. A lot of those problems were sorted out, and during the second wave, you would have seen that we did cope quite well with that. And remember, Munai, we agree with you completely. We don't believe that there should be a two-tier system, and that's why we pointed out with the stats that you can look at the fact that the 20% of the population have so much more spent on them than the public population, and we believe that nobody should be suffering financial hardship. And there should be equity in the financing mechanism, which will be achieved. I mean, that's the whole principle of universal health coverage. Then with regard to Member Shlomo's, the chair's question on COVID-19 experience, so Chair, we did have discussions with the private sector on the price of the PCR test. We did have meetings. The private sector indicated that they've got other costs that need to be included in the price. And at the end of it, everyone's aware that you know, the price from the NHLS for PCR test is 507 rand, whereas in the private sector it's 850 rand. And again, that's an example of the differentials in the price. But we have got experience. So even with the academic sector, we determined as to what price we will pay to the academic sector, and they were comfortable with that, and the Solidarity Fund then kindly funded the academic surge program. They also funded the first 450,000 tests that were done by the NHLS, and we gave the benefits to the provinces because we didn't charge them for those tests on the donation we got from the Solidarity Fund. I think that I've covered your question. So, and I think nowhere else do we have as much experience as working together as colleagues as we do in the laboratory service. So we've got a very good relationship. I would be able to pick up the phone and talk to any of the CEOs of the private labs in order to get cooperation, and we really pulled together during COVID-19. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just before we complete, I realized that I should have made a declaration at the outset when I spoke, and that is that when I was last before you at the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Health, you'll recall I was the outgoing chairperson of the board of the NHLS. I just need to inform you for the record that I have been reappointed by the minister as the chairperson of the board of the NHLS for a period of a further 3 years. That appointment has just been made in the last couple of days, so I should reflect that status with which I'm here before you today. And also just to indicate that one of the other members of our governance committee of the board, Spiwe Mayinga, has joined the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Buch and Dr. Chetty, for the replies and the answers to the clarifications that were seeked. Professor Buch, let us congratulate you, and I do this on behalf of all of the members of the Portfolio Committee on your reappointment and also to the new member. I didn't get the name properly. Well, also congratulations to that member to being appointed at NHLS. Dr. Chetty, there is one question that I would like to raise, and before we probably close, and I'm not aware whether any other members would want to also raise any other questions, since we do have a bit of time, and you've done quite well in terms of your presentation with regards to time. On my question that I raised with you on the duplication. So the question was actually, does the duplicators cover? Is it likely to deprive the NHII funded system of critical human resources? Meaning, does it not mean that pathologists, for example, would still move to the private sector when they are subcontracted by yourselves? And how do you see that then assisting incapacitating the public health system if we should be losing those human resources to the private sector? In no way am I saying the private sector is not needed, but in terms of your subcontracting system that you're envisaging. Thank you.
So I'll start with the answer and then hand over to the CEO. And Honourable Jacobs, I think you've really put your finger on the pulse of a very, very critical issue. What we do know is that the private sector is able to pay pathologists that they recruit at a higher, much higher level than we are able to pay our pathologists. And so the differential between the earnings of NHLS employed pathologists and those employed in the private sector and many of whom are partners in private practices is very wide. And that wide gap is certainly a pull factor that pulls pathologists out of the NHLS and draws them into the private sector. And in some disciplines, such as anatomical pathology, it makes it very much more challenging for us to retain enough anatomical pathologists, including those with extensive experience in the NHLS. We do work hard to offer other values and to our pathologists that we feel help retain them. But what we would imagine under the NHI is that the amount that is being paid for a test would be standardized. So whoever the provider is would get the same amount of payment for the test. So if you're doing an HIV test, whether it's done in the private or the sector or in the public entity, the NHLS, the amount that you would pay would be the same. And that means that the margins in the private sector would maybe not allow the huge differential in earnings. And that, I'm sure, would bolster the pathologist capability of the NHLS under the NHI. Dr. Chetty?
Chair, I think you've covered it.
Thank you very much for that reply, Professor Bull. There is a question raised by Honourable Dlomo, which he had forwarded to me since he is having a challenge with his connection. And he is asking, how do you plan to budget for training for your registrars trained by the NHLS? And how will you organize those budgets for training? And does your cost structure include a training budget? And you, I hope you are very welcome to to answer. And if there are any other members who would want to ask any follow-up questions, we do have about 5 minutes. You're very welcome to please indicate on the platforms to me. Thank you.
So, Honourable Jacobs, the current situation is that the NHLS receives a conditional grant to support our training responsibilities for registrars. In other words, registrars are medical doctors who are specializing in one of the pathology disciplines as microbiologists or chemical pathologists and so on. Some of their time is spent in service work and some of their time in their academic responsibilities, both in terms of our professors and lecturers who we employ, but who do teaching in the universities and supervision and training in the laboratories, as well as those who are training as specialists are on our staff on 4-year contracts, and we pay them, and a proportion of those salaries, if you like, are covered from the income we receive from the laboratory tests we do in accordance with their service role. But we also do get a conditional grant from the Department of Health to help us cover the academic teaching side of our responsibilities. So our assumption has been that even under the NHI, there will still be a conditional grant that would cover the teaching and academic responsibilities where we incur costs, because the cost of the test does not include that cost. So there would be two ways to receive it. The one would be as a conditional grant from Treasury as part of the general tax allocation, and we would feel that that would be most supportive. The other is to put a levy onto the fees for the laboratory services for the teaching and training component. But we feel it's better to keep the service costs with the service and the teaching and learning costs covered independently, because it doesn't quite make sense that when you pay for a, you know, it's a bit like when you pay for your fuel, you have certain levies added on. We had not envisaged such a levy with laboratory fees, but rather a separate grant to carry out those responsibilities. I don't know if Dr. Chetty would like to add.
So Chair, we indicated in the presentation that there needs to be more details with regards to the financing mechanism, because it is going to be a whole lot of services will need to be funded through a slicing of the budget. So we indicated, for example, that the work of the NICD around surveillance, the work of the NIOH, both of who are funded by the conditional grant, and then the teaching training research grant that we have, that ordinarily and in most countries don't get funded through the NHI. So it's either going to be that the NHI fund top slices it, as the chair says, or whether it gets done directly to Treasury. There's also a problem with the issue, or not a problem, but there's an issue that we raised with regards to the basket of services. So if the fund has whether it's an implicit or an explicit basket of services, the question does arise as to what happens if there are services outside of that basket, because the province's money will all be going towards the NHI fund, so they wouldn't necessarily have top-up funding in order to fund services outside of the basket. So those kind of details we think need to come out in the either through the regulations or in the implementation plan. But that information would be required. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. It just leaves it to me to thank NHLS for your presentation here today. To your
Chair, I've got a follow-up question, please, Chair, if you will allow me.
You are welcome, Honorable Sukarno.
That's something that I want a point of clarity, Chair. I just wanted to know, what is the reimbursement model that the NHLS will propose to be used under NHI? Is it a fee for the service, or is it a capitation? Just that point of clarity, Chair. Thank you very much.
Professor Bok or Dr. Chetty?
So, Chair, we have been working on an alternative reimbursement model through capitation, and we've been looking at the pros and cons of a number of different models. So a capitation model would be the simplest, but if you've got a fee-for-service model, will work if you've got administered prices so that the prices are set. And as to why we're calling it an alternative reinvestment model is because it may have to be a modified capitated reinvestment model that we've been looking at. So we've been having discussions with the Department of Health with regard to that. We've also looked at global budgets as well, and various other models that we could look at. But at this stage, we believe that the fee-for-service model at administered prices would be the easiest to manage. Thanks, Jen.
So if I can just add to that, I don't know if any of the other board members would like to add, but Dr. Chetty referred to the modified capitation model. So a simple capitation model is you get a certain amount per patient or a certain amount per population. The risk with a simple capitation model like that is that there's no incentive to limit the number of tests you provide, because there's money that's been paid up front, and you can order more and more and more tests without any additional fee being paid, and that could compromise the NHLS, because what happens if we've got a capitation model based on a certain set of historical trends, and then now when there's no fee for service, people take twice as much. So we get twice as many laboratory tests ordered, but we actually still have the same income. It's a bit of a real challenge, and that's why we refer to a modified capitated model if we're going that route. And you heard what Dr. Chetty said about what's easiest. And that is that we have to agree that the NHLS will provide a certain basket of services with a certain level of volumes. But if the requests escalate way beyond those volumes, then it would become a problem, and then there would have to be additional payments for those models. So, for example, let's say people have viral load tests, say once every 6 months, and then someone says, "Well, we don't have to pay for these. Let's do them every month." Suddenly, we're going to get six tests when we used to get one. Because it's a capitation model, we've only got the one amount of money, but now we've got to do six tests for the price of one. And that's why there has to be some agreement. If we are going the route of a capitation model, there has to be a clear agreement around what are the standard operating procedures around when tests are done, and what happens if the numbers, if you like, get out of hand, because it would pose a serious risk to the NHLS. If there was this sort of sudden massive increase in tests, simply because you're not paying per test, but we had no means of garnering any additional income to respond to that and provide the services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. In essence, what you're saying, Professor Volk, is that NHLS at the end, in end part in terms of the services provided, the request is made by the clinician, and that if there would not be prudent use of the test requested, it could end up into a challenge for NHLS, as it could do now, I guess, in any case. So,
well, you see, if I may, at the moment, on the fee-for-service model, if more and more tests are ordered, then we bill provinces more and more money, and they have to pay us. So provinces have an incentive to make sure that, on the one hand, patient care needs are met and patients are not deprived of tests they need, but also that that doctors are careful about not over-ordering more tests than are absolutely necessary. So the provinces do some active management, but because they don't want their bills to escalate unnecessarily without this clear benefit to their services and patients, so they manage the demand for tests. On the other hand, if under a capitation model, the provinces have no responsibility for direct payment, then there's not an incentive for them to sort of cap the number of tests ordered, but we will still have to provide them if there's over-ordering. So we're not suggesting in any way that patients shouldn't get the tests we need. Absolutely not. But I think the health market inquiry has shown that there is the potential to over-service, over-provide, over-order. We need to be careful that does not transcend into the NHI. So from our perspective, the principle of our answer is that we are flexible on the payment model according to the policy decisions and perspectives, that the a fee-for-service model that is administered fees and managed is, you know, where there's a set fee for a service, a bit like the set fees for pharmaceuticals, for medicines from your chemist. There's a process of administered fees for the medicines, which has brought down medicine costs dramatically in the country. We believe that an administered fee-for-service system would be at least one model that is very suitable to operate under the NHI, but we are not averse to other models. But if we are looking at capitation, there need to be modifications made to that capitation model, a modified capitation reimbursement system, to address the risks and concerns that I've raised, to avoid unnecessary escalation of laboratory test requests and unnecessary escalation, therefore, of laboratory costs, because whatever you spend in the laboratory, you can't spend on other aspects of patient care. So I hope that, I'm sorry we're giving you such a long answer, but the answer is a little bit nuanced. Administered fee-for-service will work. A modified capitation, and it's the simplest, a modified capitation reimbursement model with appropriate modifications to address the concerns that Dr. Chetty and I have raised would also work.
Thank you very much. I see there's one hand. Yes, I'll be with you now, Honorable Munyai. Thank you very much for the reply, Honorable Professor Buch. I'm going to give you now, Honorable Munyai. We're getting close to 14:50 when we were to have ended and SRC to be presenting. So I will take the very last hand, which is that of Honorable Munyai, and if your response can be short this time, Professor Book or Dr. Chetty. Thank you, Honorable Munyai.
Honorable Chair, I just want to understand the clarity here as a matter of follow-up, whether the NHLS as an organization, they agree to clinical guidelines in this context, the clinical guidelines and the protocols to be put in place is that they are proposing in this regard. This will include, for instance, referral pathways implemented by NHLS services. Is that the position?
No.
To be precise and clear.
So the quick answer is that we there are two levels of clinical guidelines. There's general clinical guidelines for practice in hospitals, and there are clinical guidelines in relation to laboratory services. We support both, but Dr. Chetty will add to that. You asked for a quick answer.
We also take some of those guidelines, and we've got electronic gatekeeping where we can easily apply some of those guidelines, and our electronic gatekeeping has been instituted and implemented in all of the provinces. Thanks, Jess.
Thank you very much for the short and sweet answer. That brings us to the end of the presentation of NHLS. I have already thanked you. I'll thank you again to all of the board members of NHLS, all of those who came to present on behalf of NHLS. We appreciate it, and you are very welcome to leave our platform. I believe that the SAMRC has already joined us, and I just need to get an indication from our secretary, Ms. Majalamba. Thank you.
Yes, they have joined, Dr. Simpson.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. So, Ms. Majalamba, can you give me an indication? I'm trying to look up with the system. I would assume it would be the president of the SAMRC, but I cannot really, it's lots to scroll. Maybe you can help me very quickly to tell me who has joined from the SAMRC.
Yes, I have joined Dr. Jacobs, Ms. Rachel, and Ms. Tamara Credo. Or Dr. Tamara Credo.
Thank you very much. Very welcome to the SAMRC today, to the public hearings on the NHI Bill. We have been doing this for the past 3 days. We appreciate you coming to make your representations to us. You are very welcome to do that. You have 45 minutes to do your presentation. And then there will be clarity-seeking questions for another 35 minutes. So whoever is representing, we've heard of two names. I heard the name of Rachel, and then another name, I think, of Dr. Tamara, Rachel Dukes. You're very welcome. I think I'm not going to do much introductions now, since we have already taken a minute of your time. Please continue with your presentation.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Honourable Jacobs, and members of the Portfolio Committee, and other attendees at this presentation. I want to start by introducing myself. I have been to the Portfolio Committee before, but in case you don't remember, I'm the Executive Scientist for Research Strategy and the Intramural Units at the SAMRC. And I'm leading the delegation from the SAMRC today because our president, Professor Glenda Gray, is not available, unfortunately. We are very pleased to have this opportunity, and thank you very much for inviting us to address the Portfolio Committee. I will just very quickly point out the other members of staff of the SAMRC who
yes,
are present. We have Jeffrey Mpakleli, who is the Vice President of the MRC, Lynn Hamner, Tamara Credo, who will be presenting with me, Kim Jonas, Geetesh Solanki, and Victoria Pillay van Veek. And I will talk to you for a bit, and then Tamara will give you the main bones of our presentation, and then all members of the SAMRC will be available to answer questions as they particularly pertain to their area of input into this presentation. So I'd like to just start by thanking you and by mentioning that, Tamara, if we can have the next slide, that the submission that we're giving you orally today follows on a written submission that was made by members of the MRC staff on the November 2019 NHI bill. Next slide. We're going to give our presentation in three sections. I'll just briefly give you some background, and then tomorrow we'll talk about the key topics and recommendations and provide a brief conclusion, and then we're very open to questions. As you know, the NHI bill is particularly important because it's the largest set of reforms proposed for the health system since 1994. The SAMRC remains committed to the provision of the best possible healthcare for South Africans and completely supportive of the principles underpinning the National Health Insurance Bill. We note that the reforms are being introduced at a time when we face major national and global social and economic challenges. COVID-19, the pandemic, has had a profound impact on economies across the world, including our own economy, and funding available for healthcare and demand for health services. It's also revealed fault lines within healthcare service delivery, access to critical health information, and has created opportunities for efficient collaborative work and improvement in some places, particularly health technology assessment processes. Next slide. The bill, as it currently sets out, describes a specific two-phase timeline for implementation, and we support the stepwise resource-informed approach outlined in the bill. We believe that NHI decisions should be evidence-based, and partners such as the SAMRC are very well placed to provide support through the conduct of relevant research for decision-making related to NHI. The government pilot projects have been already conducted and they are valuable, and we believe that the implementation steps to be piloted and evaluated and readjusted should be informed by the pilot projects. Regular stakeholder engagement, particularly in fora for participatory decision making, is absolutely critical for sound decision making in this process, and needs to include consultation with public and private providers at all levels of the health system. I want to hand over to Tamara. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and colleagues. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Tamara Credo. So on the background that Rachel kindly kicked us off with, we thought we would extract from the submission some very specific ideas and concepts and recommendations that we think could be taken up or considered, and we're grateful for the opportunity. I think one thing you would have noticed, from our mandate is that we think that research should be a very important part of NHI planning and implementation. And I guess based on the whole notion that knowledge is cumulative and it doesn't make sense to be starting things from scratch or doing things without considering exactly what the current status is. And I think, outside of the actual bill, we note that there's a lot of work that can be done to really take stock of where we are in a lot of aspects of the health systems. So we think perhaps what may be useful is the establishment of a research advisory committee to advise the minister. This isn't part of one of the committees already in place, and this committee could advise on commissioning research and establishing a framework for doing this. As you know, the SAMRC is primary funder of health research in the country in terms of our own funding processes, and could be involved and support this. We think that this committee could receive oral and written presentations of research findings, so that we can really critique and make sure that the methods being used and the evidence that we use is informative. We could report on these key learnings from the research if we had some ring-fenced funding for NHI-related research, with, like that this committee could coordinate. And this committee could make recommendations on the arrangements for research and data access. So within the MRC, we have many functions. Some of the intramural units are responsible for conducting important research, and the burden of disease unit, for example, has been instrumental in collecting data on excess mortality, particularly in the context of COVID now. But access to information is critical, and we'd like to see this strengthened in NHI and perhaps through some of the aspects of the bill. So a very specific recommendation we have in the Chapter 7, where the advisory committees are outlined, would be to perhaps add this recommendation. So the Minister must, after consultation with the board by notice of the Gazette, establish a committee to be known as a Research Advisory Committee, as one of the committees of the fund. Membership of this advisory committee, appointed by the Minister, must consist of members from institutions such as the Research Council, public health entities, higher education institutions, and with civil society representation, and that the chairperson could be appointed by the minister. So we've used, based on the wording within the bill, to kind of to add this particular recommendation. So that's our first point. The next is a point that we noted in the submission, which was gathered from all members of the MRC were able to contribute here, is that accreditation was noticed as a potential concern because of the risk of privatizing healthcare delivery. So we know from the WHO prerequisites for successful UHC, you need a functioning healthcare system. And so the accreditation process is critically important as it's envisioned by the bill. But what could happen is that it could render many of the current operational public sector facilities ineligible to be contracted by the NHI fund if they don't meet the basic accreditation. And this can result in a heavily private sector dependent delivery model. So this is one of the concerns raised. So this accreditation process carries the risk of socializing the funding of healthcare, but privatizing the provision. So to be more specific, in section 39 of the bill, where there's specific mention of the fund and how accreditation, so it mentions that the fund withdraws accreditation of healthcare service provider or health establishment or refuses to renew accreditation. And it has certain criteria under there. But what it doesn't make provision for is whether, you know, if at the moment it's very dichotomous. You either have accreditation, yes or no, but what happens in the kind of interim space and whether there's any possibility of provisional accreditation pending progress on a roadmap for improving care and facilities to meet the full standards of full accreditation. So we just feel that there's an element that could be added to make sure that there aren't breaks in service when some facilities perhaps or healthcare providers do not meet the full accreditation. So moving on to the next point is a particular interest of all of ours is prevention, preventive, promotive and primary healthcare and strengthening this as part of the NHI. And this is something that is recognized as the foundation of the health system. The WHO and others recommend increased prioritization of investments in primary healthcare. And we suggest that the bill include a commitment to invest a specific proportion of funding for primary healthcare to be determined prior to finalization of the bill. We didn't come with a prescriptive amount of what this specific commitment is, but we felt that it would be useful to have a number in there so that that we prevent prevent under funding these kinds of services. So we've recommended inserting a new point into 35.4 that could read something along the lines of funds for primary healthcare services constitute no less than a certain percentage of funding for NHI with a progressive increase in the proportion allocated. Thank you. So I'll move to the next point. So this is particular interest, but to technical support institutions, and for example, the mention of the Health Technology Agency, Health Technology Assessment Agency. So we note that products and services made available under MHI must be selected on the basis of the best available evidence to ensure equitable, transparent, effective distribution of public resources. And that this is then governed by establishing the correct technical support structures, such as the Health Technology Assessment Agency and the Office of Health Products Procurement. And there was just some concern that these agencies should not necessarily report to the ministerial advisory committees, but there should be space to ensure that these agencies have some space for independent scientific opinion. They should perhaps have their own board and need to have provision for independent publication of findings that come out of these agencies as part of good public good. And another specific point is that the definition of health technology assessment is omitted from the list of definitions, and it would be useful to include that. And in our submission, we put forward the WHO recommendation, which is one that could be considered. So in recommendation to this particular point around these technical support agencies, we would like to recommend adding provisions to the bill to provide a more clear mandate for the further development where some of these functions are already existing or establishment of these support agencies. Describe the definition, as I mentioned, of and then also describe the scope and functions, the level of autonomy of these technical support institutions, and outline how they will interact with the other NHI committees and units. So how the various committees and units interact and is not very clear when you try and draw it out in an organogram. It would be useful to have that a little bit more clearly outlined. Provisions could also be added to prescribe the role these institutions have in functioning of the NHI. So, for example, the HTA agency in determining the basket of services. And maybe it's worth noting that in the course, you know, COVID, as Rachel mentioned, you know, threw up a lot of challenges and issues and fault lines in the functioning of things. The SAMRC has actually been able to enhance our collaboration with the Ministry of Health and with the specific department looking at COVID recommendations, clinical practice guideline development, and in fact strengthen methods there. So I think there's a lot of learning that can come, and obviously this is something that's happened subsequent to our submission. So moving on, health information system, we've already mentioned, is critical. We have a number of members joining us on the call from the Burden of Disease Research Unit. So Section 34 identifies the need for the development and maintenance of the health information system, as well as the need for health workers to comply with provisions in the National Health Act. But we need to clarify how organizations responsible for prioritizing and conducting or commissioning research will access health information research for this research. So how does the information coordinate across the different provinces, for example, or the different platforms that are out there? So not necessarily about centralizing this, but about working out the coordination. So it would also be useful to clarify roles of various organizations in supporting health information systems, such as the South African Medical Research Council and the National Public Health Institute of South Africa's role in surveillance and epidemic preparedness. So we strongly support the bill's outline for health information system, but we've come up with some recommendations to perhaps monitor, and these are very specific ideas to add to the bill, to monitor service outcomes. So in Section 39, we suggest adding an additional data point. Section 39 speaks to the data that will be collected. The healthcare service provider or health establishment must submit information to the fund for recording the health patient registration system, including, and there's a list of factors, and there's nothing yet listed about the outcomes of someone's care. So where possible, we think this would be very useful and very informative for research in the country. Critical, in fact. A further recommendation around health information systems is to Section 40, where we suggest that in addition to what is already there, which are more general statements, that we also think that monitoring of quality of care and care outcomes should be more clearly included in the bill, as well as a point in 40 and point 3 where to monitor quality of care and care outcomes. Just to make to clarify the kinds of data that are critical for us to be monitoring and would be helpful to have in the bill already outlined. Further in section 40, information, we suggest just an addition of a phrase, information concerning an identifiable user through name or ID number could be added to be more specific about how we create these identifiable groupings. Thank you, and I'll move on to the next point. So looking at payment models, the NHI bill is detailed and prescriptive regarding how service providers will be paid in some sections. So global budget, diagnosis-related groups, capitation, section 35. It's also mentioned in 41, but not in the specifics. And the feedback from through our submission is that the specific prescriptions may require bill amendments as the NHI implementation proceeds and the processes mature. And in fact, our suggestion is more about softening the wording around Section 35 to set out the underlying principles in deciding how to remunerate providers for service rather than prescribing the specific payment mechanisms, because we think this may change as the implementation unfolds. Okay. This brings me to some feedback and some points about the role of medical aid schemes, and particularly Section 33, there's a short paragraph, and the bill puts forward that the Minister of Health is to decide when the NHI is to be fully implemented, but it's unclear what criteria will be used for this determination. It also mentions there that the changes in the role of medical aid schemes is linked and will only come into being once full implementation of the NHI is signed off by the minister. The bill states that medical schemes will offer complementary services not covered by the NHI. So our suggestions here is that the role of deciding when NHI has been fully implemented should be delegated to an independent committee that reports rather to Parliament rather than as it's currently put forward. And that the decisions around how this will be made, how this decision will be made should be transparent. At the moment, the criteria, which should align with some areas of the bill and which ones need to be in place prior to implementation, could be made more clear. Just to add, although complementary services offered by medical schemes should not encompass or encroach on essential population health services covered in the public sector, medical schemes may provide essential services where these are not available in a specific setting, which is not which does happen in the health system. So our recommendation to Section 31 is some additional text that says once national health insurance has been fully implemented, as determined by an independent committee reporting to Parliament through regulations in the Gazette, medical schemes may only offer complementary cover to services not reimbursable by the fund or that are not available from a provider contracted to the fund. I'm moving on. Just the last few points we wanted to raise is on behalf of the group is key population groups. So there's a section that outlines transitional arrangements, describing the phased implementation, and in section 57.4 puts forward purchasing of healthcare service benefits, but omits some of the critical areas specifically related to mental health, sexual and reproductive health services, and adolescent healthcare. And it was felt from the MRC staff that contributed to the submission that these areas really are omitted from the bill as it currently stands. So we have some suggestions to add to the wording within this particular section of the bill, and that would be to add in sexual reproductive health services, child and adolescent health services, mental health care services, clinical psychologists, mental health practitioners, physiotherapists, dietitians, and others, just to make sure that this section, although not meant to be completely comprehensive of everything, does include some of the key areas that are important for vulnerable groups in our country. So thank you. And moving lastly, so the last section that we thought Trophy really strengthened is public engagement, and we're very fortunate to be here engaging, and for that we're very grateful. And the bill does make provision for engagement with stakeholders. But this could be further expanded, and just keeping in mind that that putting various stakeholders all into one group can obviously create, can be disempowering for some. So there's a broad list of contributors, and we need to understand how the contributions can actually be meaningfully heard and brought forward. So in Section 27, there is a stakeholder advisory committee, but we thought the role and functions and membership could be elaborated, and also suggest that it doesn't always have to be an in-person meeting. That was an addition. But further, the patient advocacy groups perhaps should get a more prominent space. They're critical voices. They need to have a forum for expressing their views, and possibly distinct from service providers and some of the other stakeholders. And so we suggest a structure be created to enable these organized patient voices to have an input at each level, from the district to provide input direct to the board. So colleagues, that comes to the end of the recommendations that we have from the MRC. And just to thank you all again, to the chair, to the colleagues, honorable colleagues, and to say that MRC is entirely in support of the principles of NHI. In 2019, we hosted a national universal health coverage dialogue, which brought together policymakers, researchers, and other stakeholders. And we really believe that MRC has wonderful research capacity. We have convening power, and we work in the spirit of collaboration. So we thank you very much for your time, and thanks also to the colleagues with me from the MRC today. Thank you, Honourable Chair. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the SAMRC who wants to say anything today?
Not at this point, Honourable Chair. I think it would be good to hear the questions from the committee, and then other members will respond.
Thank you very much for your presentation and that you have taken the time to come and present to us in person. We appreciate this presentation. We do have a couple of members of the Portfolio Committee who have questions to raise. The very first one is Honourable Sukacha, followed by Honourable then by myself. Members, are there any of you who would want to raise any questions? Please feel free to raise either on this platform or to send on the group where we normally indicate that we would like to ask any questions. So far, we have myself and Honourable Sukacha, and then I am going to ask some questions on behalf of Honourable Gormo, who is struggling with his network, but he had sent those questions to me. So are there any other hands?
I'm covered, thank you, Chair.
Sukacha in the absence, Honourable Van Staden?
No, I'm said I'm covered, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. In the absence of any other hands, I'm going to ask Honourable Sukacha to please raise his question.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Let me thank the MRC for the presentation. I just have got two clarity-seeking questions, Chairperson. The first one is on Section 9. The MRC is saying that they are making addition on the provisional accreditation. I just want to check, would it not be addressed by the current National Quality Health Improvement Plan? That's my first question, Chair. My second question, it's around their submission on Section 35, which they suggest should include relates to earmark funding for the PHC. If all services are earmarked, will this not allow flexibilities in case of emergencies? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Sukacha. I'm going to ask the questions which I thought I would have wanted to, and then I will ask the questions as raised by Honourable Blomer. Now, you've said quite a bit on the research part, and of course that is what the SAMRC does, but your point on the research advisory committee, are you suggesting that this should be advisory, a separate advisory committee, or can it be integral to the fund as we see, as contained in section 20, subsection 3? And then on your health technology assessment agency, do you think that the country can afford to establish this capacity or capability in the short term? Or do you think it would also be possible to do this in the longer term? And are structures like NICE or NICE in the UK established? If you have any indication of that, whether it was also right in the beginning at the Big Bang, or is it something that was brought in on over a longer period? Then, there are questions which were raised by Honorable Dlomo, which I would just like to go to and read his questions. And he is asking, is there a need to put in legislation the role of the MRC and the other bodies? And why, when there are many research organizations, including universities, will have to do that with the MRC? And then, so is there a suggestion by the MRC in them then showing so many amendments to be made, whether the whole bill should be rewritten to meet their needs, or what would be their suggestion with regards to this? At this point in time, those are the questions which I have noted. There's also one posted by Honorable Munyai, who is also struggling with network challenges. He is asking that again, a similar question, whether the legislation with regards to the SAMRC be amended to align with the NHI, or whether cognition can be taken with of the legislation as put forward in the NHI bill. And the very last one relates from Honorable Munyai is the question relating to Section 33 on medical aid providing the same services as part of the NHI services. Will that not create this inequality that NHI is aiming to reduce? Oh, yes, thank you very much. You may answer those questions, but also any other of your members who are present on the platform. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the questions. I would like to have a first go answering them, and then I'd like to invite my colleagues to join in and add to that. So the first question from Honourable Sokacha was related to Section 9 and the question of provisional accreditation, and was it not currently addressed? And it was, we feel that this is something, you know, maybe we need to check it further, but we feel that the issue of provisional accreditation may be something that may not be entirely currently addressed at the present moment. And there is quite a substantial concern, and we know it's a concern that's perceived not just amongst colleagues at the SAMRC, but more widely, that there may be issues around the accreditation of many existing facilities. We think the accreditation process overall is incredibly important in ensuring the quality of care that patients really deserve, and we don't want to see the accreditation process undermined by a situation where if standards for accreditation are high and vigorous, that there are many very important health services, that health facilities that are not able to meet those standards. In relation to the question about Section 35 and earmarked funding, the reason why we've raised this is that it is a problem with health systems across the world that hospital care consumes an increasing proportion of the budget within the health system. and unless it is very firmly checked, the primary healthcare budget is squeezed. It's firmly our belief that unless there's sufficient investment in primary healthcare, we will not be able to stem the tide of patients presenting with more severe health consequences into the tertiary and secondary systems. And so we will not be able to contain costs within the health sector. And so adequate investment in primary care, starting at the level that we're at the moment, and that would be, we didn't have the calculation at our fingertips when we were putting this together, but I'm sure it's something that can be determined amongst our economists. But we believe that the current investment in primary healthcare plus a small supplement is the level at which there should be the starting point, but it should be incrementally increased in order to be able to ensure that we curb the otherwise unrelenting tide of increasing illness across the country that will require treatment through more expensive services provided at a hospital level. So, Honourable Jacobs, the research subcommittee, we believe should not be part of the fund, but it should be a separate advisory committee. And the reason is that it's incredibly important that a research advisory committee should be independent and should be able to give independent advice. Whereas if it is within the fund, it may not have the ability to give independent advice. It needs to be able to independently advise the minister and obviously also independently advise the fund. And this is absolutely critical for impartial voices from the research sector to be able to provide guidance and input into the process. And I think we've seen partly with the ministerial advisory committees during COVID, the incredibly valuable role that a voice of research can play in input into these types of committees. With respect to health technology assessment, it's an interesting question about when NICE was established. The answer is the mid to late 1990s. And that obviously was not the time when the NHS was established. However, the world of health systems research and health management moved very rapidly globally from the 1980s onwards. And the idea of having something like a health technology assessment organization like NICE had not really been on the table in any country much before the mid-90s. We've got the advantage of setting up NHI 25 years later. And so I think it would be incredibly valuable to build in best practice from other systems from the start. I don't believe that this needs to be a completely separate entity with a separate board and management and financial structure. It could be something that could be embedded within an existing institution. But it would be an incredibly valuable contribution towards the management of NHI. And again, health technology assessment like NICE needs to be completely integrated into the system, but otherwise seen to be giving independent advice. So Honourable and Lovu asked about the roles of the MRC and the drafting of the bill, and I believe that the question was very similar to that posed by Honourable Munyai. I will mention that we have in this presentation given a series of suggestions of areas where extremely small changes could be made to this otherwise very robust and excellent bill in order to strengthen it. And we are not in any way suggesting major changes to the bill. These are very small changes, and I understand that the process of seeking external advice is to seek this type of input. We believe that the SAMRC has got a very valuable role to play in terms of supporting NHI, and we have many capabilities, including our ability to put out requests for proposals and manage funding to enable the generation of research knowledge to guide government policy across the wide range of different research providers in the country. And this is something that we are confident that the Minister and the will want to draw on in terms of strengthening the input of knowledge and knowledge guidance into the NHI process. And then the last question I wanted to comment on was our recommendation related to Section 33, an inequality. And it's an interesting question because I really think that the answer depends on whether your approach is a glass half full or a glass half empty approach. I'm currently addressing you from Limpopo, and in the area I live, there are many services that are not available. I think it would be extremely problematic if, for example, probably not me, but maybe a family member or neighbour wanted to secure a termination of pregnancy and was not able to get that provided in the public sector, either because the services are not available or because we know that we have not overcome the opposition of health workers to ensure that these types of services are available in the way that it was envisaged in the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act. These services then should be accessible through the private sector, if necessary, using medical aid. And I believe that it is unequal for somebody to be able to use medical aid for that purpose, when in fact, if they lived in Cape Town, for example, they might be able to get the same service provided within the public sector. So I think that inequality can be looked at in different ways, and but it is unequal if people are denied access to important and effective and affordable treatments and must use their own funding for that, rather than medical aid if they have medical aid, if these treatments are not available in what would otherwise be the core package of service provided. So thank you very much. Those are my initial responses. And I would like to invite other members of the MRC team who would like to provide input to come in at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. They're very welcome to Dr. Tamara Cheatham, and the rest of your team. You're all very welcome.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I have nothing to add there. I think that covers the responses very comprehensively. Thank you very much to Professor Jukes. But perhaps other of the colleagues who work in other content areas may want to add. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, nothing from my side. Thanks. I think Rachel has covered most of the questions.
Thank you very much. To all the professors and all the doctors who came to present to us today. I'm just trying to see if there's any other question that was raised by any of the other members. Members, you're still very welcome to ask any questions. We do that on our WhatsApp platform, as we normally do, just indicate. And you can also do that on this platform. So I am looking for hands. No other hands? I think that brings us to the end. Thank you very much once again from myself on behalf of our chairperson of the Portfolio Committee and also the members of the Portfolio Committee for your presentation. I really thoroughly enjoyed it, and we're looking forward to working with you in the future. I think that having said, that brings our meeting to an end today. And goodbye to everyone, and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.